Hello and welcome to Monaco's food and drink program, The Menu. I am Markus Hippi. This week we meet private chef Saima Khan, whose cooking has become a hit around the world.
We just started talking about the way that food connects people, not from a cliche point of view, but that whole breaking bread scenario. They loved how I style the food.
Then we discover cooking from Syria, a country that deserves much more attention for its cuisine.
Food for the Syrians and the traditions and the culture of food culture is like really monumental.
We will also hear a top dinner soundtrack recommendation and this week's food and drink headlines. That is all ahead on this week's edition of The Menu here on Monaco 24. First today we meet the private chef Saima Khan, who has found great success with her businesses The Hampstead Kitchen and Social Bubbling. Saima, although based in London, has flown around the world cooking for private clients. She has cooked for Obama's, for Bill and Melinda Gates too, and as you may well expect, she won't reveal the names of most of her A-list clients. Pandemic has obviously changed her plans, but thanks to her savvy business instinct, she has succeeded also in changing the way she works. I spoke to Saima a bit earlier about the pandemic, how she impresses customers who have gone through all the world's best restaurants, and how the way we eat is changing. But first, she told me about the incredible events that led to her leaving her career in finance, switching over to cooking.
Well, much like most people in banking, you're happily sort of plodding along, thinking that this is your life. And I had a chance meeting. I actually enjoyed what I was doing. I was in sort of risk regulations and running sort of projects. And I bumped into my ultimate boss, Warren Buffett, in a waiting room in Omaha. We just got chatting about food, and anybody who's read about him knows that he loves steak. He loves meat. So I said, oh, if you're ever in New York, you know, you must come over for dinner. I didn't really care how ridiculous that sounded, but that's a way of making new friends. So he said, no, I'll hold you to that. And that I didn't think anything of it. And then 2 months later, Warren decides through his PA to say, can him and his wife come over for dinner? I'm like, sure. So I start planning this dinner of just like Persian and sort of South Asian flavors. And a couple of days before, he said, I've got two friends in town who have been to these countries, love this food, but also like your philanthropy story. So I've been doing various sort of charity projects since I started my first job through my sort of parents. And lo and behold, I didn't know who these people were, but you were never going to say no to your ultimate boss. So I opened the door and I see Bill and Melinda Gates and Warren Buffett and his wife at my door. And I just couldn't process what was going on. Didn't have time to process. And then I just kind of just had this lovely dinner in my tiny apartment. And we just started talking about the way that food connects people, not from a cliche point of view, but from a point of that whole breaking bread scenario. And they loved how I styled the food. You know, it was bringing up lots of turquoise plates and we were eating with our hands and it had like a Persian playlist. And so Bill and Melinda said, well, we're having a little donor dinner with her friends. And could I possibly fly down to Palo Alto and do this dinner for 20 people? I said, oh my God, it will be a dream. I can easily cook for 50 people. And so I turned up to their house about, I don't know, a couple of months later, and was sort of creating this lovely dinner with some, you know, handwritten menus. And you've got the people like the Obamas and Clintons and Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt sitting, Mark Zuckerberg at the dinner table. And I just couldn't get my head around it. I was like, my life is becoming more and more bizarre. But they really connected with the food because it wasn't white sort of fine bone china plates. It wasn't smudge kind of food. It was food piled up high. It created a feeling of togetherness, communal sort of dining. And I think people just responded really, really well. And then, you know, a couple of days later, Warren and Bill said, look, you have a gift of telling this story. Why don't you just take a year's sabbatical and research on food? And that's kind of how the story started. And that was 2012. I didn't think too much about it. I just thought, okay, let's just see what's out there. I was curious. And then I set up the business in 2013. And then because of those sort of people, they were sort of recommending their friends. And that's how I got into that kind of world. That makes up about 27% of my business right now, with sort of tech com billionaires and doing charity dinners and working for foundations. But primarily the reason why we called it the Hamster Kitchen was because I was living here. And it was, this area is quite lovely because you have people who are well-traveled, who've lived in different countries, they know flavors, and there was a real demand for something a bit more visceral, a bit more emotive. And people were looking for something different. And, you know, it's luck or hard work, whatever you want to call it. But it just seemed to resonate with a lot of people. And that kind of started our journey. And we just quickly snowballed locally. That was important, to have a local presence rather than be the celeb chef, which I didn't really want to become. So that's kind of how we started our business in a nutshell.
What's an amazing success story. I'm wondering nowadays, when you are serving food to these people, as you mentioned, they are well-traveled and they've been to a number of the world's best restaurants. How do you impress them? What is your secret and approach?
So we work through the menus. At the end of the day, people just want to have a real feel. So the thing is, when you see a table and you just style it with, I put lots of pomegranates and grapes, I do a very understated table, but the focus is always on the food. It's not about three forks and, you know, so many kind of charger plates. It's just a simple, colorful plate. But when people walk in and they can smell the food, their senses start to get activated. And also, I'm a feeder. So I start telling them about the food. I'll tell them about the funny stories of people I've cooked for. But then I offset it with some of the philanthropy stories. So I think then people connect with that dinner in every sense of the word, rather than the stuffy chef in a white jacket who's just introducing the dish and that's it. So that's how I think I stood out, where it becomes more of an experience as opposed to just a lovely plate of food. And I can only go by what my clients say. And I've got clients say, I know you're really busy, but we would love for you to just come and tell your story to our guests. And I do that because sometimes you get really great donations. So I think it's the person who runs the business as well. And my team, we make sure that we really connect with people because that's what makes it more memorable. That's what we've tried to do. And I think that's the thing that works for us right now.
And also, you don't obviously only operate in London. You are eager to travel to places wherever you are needed. Tell me about how that works. You bought these private jets bound for some Greek islands. Do you travel with your ingredients?
Well, sometimes, if it's someone's private jet, I will take all my napkins, tablecloth, cutlery, everything with me. But before that, when someone approaches us, we try and understand what their vision is. And people don't want like some fancy pants sort of catering company to just come and serve canapés. They want food and the alcohol to be the focus. They want their guests to feel really well looked after. So we talk about menus. So that gives me an indication of what type of party it is. Then I work with the local suppliers to see if I can get that food. And then I'll just take my ingredients, freshly roasted spices. If I can't get pomegranates, I'll take my pomegranates on board. And then we start sort of creating the menu is already agreed beforehand, but it's quite easy. Once you have all of your styling and your spices, it's quite easy then to create that experience. We did something even in just before lockdown in late August, a client of ours had these really big plans in this villa, some amazing French chef to come, and that couldn't happen. So instead, we went to this lovely vineyard in Côte de Provence, and I did a Persian menu with a French twist under this sublime tree with the most exquisite vintage champagne. And there were about 12 people, and it was just lots and lots of food, like mezze, starters, mains, lots of lamb, pulled pork, fish. And at the end of the day, there were just mountains of food in the middle of the table, platters and platters of food. So yeah, it's like a story. We start building it up. So it is quite easy to do. I mean, logistically, there's a lot of work that has to go in before you even board the plane.
Obviously, you're not traveling that much at the moment because of the pandemic. What has your experience been like? How has the pandemic impacted you?
A hell of a lot. I mean, when it started, I got COVID myself. So I think that also changes your view. Then you want to be really responsible. 2 months it took me to get better. And I had just hosted my parents' 50th wedding anniversary. And then it was our time around March to suddenly start getting busy. and being 2 months out of action. But the biggest thing I did was try to predict what the trend would be. So I got on a couple of Zoom calls with people like Jansi Strickler, the CEO of Kickstarter, and he already started his discussions. And that was the first time I heard that this pandemic will last until 2021 autumn. Now, our UK news was talking about that things would get better in the summer, but I looked at the worst case scenario, so I knew that I had to change my business. Nobody was doing private dining at home, so we created Social Bubbling, which was this concept, and the bubble concept was just starting to be talked about in the US, at places like Silicon Valley, San Francisco and California, hadn't caught on so much in London. So I played with this idea, and there was a think tank that went on where you could send a proposal about how to pivot your business, but not pivot just for something short term, but this, if the pandemic lasted more than 18 months, how would you have to change your business in order to keep it afloat? So I did this white paper and it got chosen. So he chose 5 people. And so I got a whole hour with this guy who gave me the most amazing insight about how to brand this new concept. So Social Bubbling is about us delivering food securely, but obviously we can't have staff there. And because I had positive antibodies, so what I did was set up a table with everything, tablecloths, napkins, and create a private home dining experience, either in your garden or in your home while you're away. And then we would pick up the dishes 2.5 hours later. Well, we were the only people in London who were doing that. And we tried it out and we wanted to see if people would warm up to the idea. But the response was amazing. The press that we got and the interest was because it just felt like a bit of a ray of sunshine, a bit of hope. And then I don't really cook dinners for 2 people, but Date Night Bubble, which was a suggestion of Jansi, that people want to, especially in the States, Date Night Bubble is very popular. And that's been the most popular thing. Like, people are prepared to pay a hell of a lot of money for just to celebrate an anniversary or a birthday. And that's still the most popular thing right now, that or a bubble for 6. So yeah, that's kind of how it started. And then we had to chop and change. Then we saw the trend. We're not really wedding caterers. We saw that micro weddings became the thing. And people were spending money on the best champagne and the best sort of food. And then again, it's just word of mouth and coverage. We got a mention in the FT, and also one of our clients, she was like a fashion editor, had a very low-key wedding just for 11 people, and she hired us to do the food. And so that kind of, all those little things help. And then word of mouth, pretty much I would say 80% is word of mouth. So people can see we're quite responsible, we have a structure, we're making sure that our clients are safe and our staff are safe. And that's kind of how we started, and it kind of grew. And then we had to change our branding. We couldn't say private chef or party caterers because no one was doing parties. So we said Social Bubbling, a new way to dine by the Hampstead Kitchen. And it just became something fun. So I think how you brand something also attracts your clientele. I think that's what I tried to do, and it worked. So, you know, I was lucky. I was fortunate.
Absolutely. Well, hopefully we are now on the final stretch when it comes to fighting the pandemic. What kind of plans do you have for the future when things get a bit better?
Well, we're already seeing a trend. So even with the dates now, most of my clientele are not in a rush to go out to restaurants unless they're established restaurants where they have clear social distancing rules. So I have lots of friends in the business. So what I'm predicting and what I'm seeing is that there's going to be more emphasis on people to celebrate at home. I mean, we're pretty much fully booked now for weekends up until October, especially when the announcement came out a week and a half ago. But we're just seeing that even people who didn't previously hire a private chef are thinking it's a better idea because they can control the environment. So right now, I'm just focused on getting up until sort of autumn. Beyond that, we see that when more people are vaccinated, people will start having bigger and larger parties. But I think some trends are set to stay. I'm definitely seeing couples who are getting married having smaller weddings. people are staying home more. People are not doing destination-based stuff. I mean, the uber rich will still have ingenious ways of celebrating abroad. So that's great. That's our kind of biggest sort of bread and butter at the moment. But I think there's going to be more willingness for people to get together more often now. People aren't going to wait for special occasions because we've been so deprived of meeting our friends and family. I mean, I myself, I'm used to having friends pop in during the week and I haven't been able to kind of host anybody, to be honest. So I'm hoping that people are just going to meet up often and there'll be more low-key things going on. So that's what I'm planning for 2021 at least.
Private chef Saima Khan there. She's the woman behind the Hampstead Kitchen and Social Bubbling. You are listening to The Menu on Monocle 24. Let's next continue with this week's food and drink headlines. Here is Monocle's Maylee Evans.
Thanks, Marcus. Let's begin here in London, where new diversity scholarships have just been announced to try and encourage black and ethnic minority students to become sommeliers. Open to candidates from all over the world, the Golden Vines Diversity Scholarships are launched by the Gerard Basset Wine Education Charitable Foundation in memory of the great sommelier. There are currently only 3 BAME Master Sommeliers in the world, and the scholarships hope to change this by providing funds for the costly examinations as well as prestigious internships. Now it's a short trip north to Scotland. Venison is usually a staple of British menus, however, with the lockdown-enforced closures, vast amounts of this premium produce has been left unused. In an initiative that will not only support those managing the wild deer populations in the UK, but also those in need of nutritious meals, the Country Food Trust is buying excess stock and distributing it to food banks across the country. It has so far delivered almost 300,000 meals using venison, helping communities whilst also reducing food waste at the same time. Across the Atlantic now, to the US, where a new book has just been released detailing the country's history of cider making. When you think of cider, your first thoughts are probably of Somerset, Normandy, or perhaps Asturias. However, American Cider, a modern guide to a historic beverage, explains how the oldest drink in America has carved its own unique niche across the pond. Experts Craig Cavallo and Dan Pucci leave no stone unturned, covering everything from region-specific apples to the new wave of American cider producers. Finally to Singapore, where the Michelin Guide's gastrobar pop-ups are kicking into gear. This month, a range of the city's Michelin-recommended restaurants and bars have collaborated for an exclusive menu of cocktails and accompanying nibbles to showcase the diversity of the food and drink scene. With themes ranging from Latin America to Sweden, it provides a welcome global culinary journey without even leaving the city. That's this week's news. Back to you, Marcus.
Thanks, Maylee. You are listening to The Menu on Monocle 24. It's soon time for this week's dinner soundtrack recommendation, but before that, a new cookbook release introduces to us food from a country that has until now been better known for its wars than its cuisine. Sumac, Recipes and Stories from Syria is a beautiful release by Anas Atassi, who is Syrian himself and nowadays based in Amsterdam. The book is full of delicious recipes and stories and paints a picture of a culture that values cuisine highly. I spoke to Anas and he first explained what he'd like people to learn about the food of his home country.
I think Syrian cuisine is, of course, the fresh ingredients, but also the spices, and that also makes it authentic. But I think on top of this, there is really the food culture and the food tradition on how we eat and the celebrations we have around food. And I think that is what, for me, makes the food even more delicious. And I hope with the stories from the book that this is resonating a bit more on the stories and makes you feel and taste the food a bit more.
That's right. You have just released your book, Sumac, Recipes and Stories from Syria. And in this book, you write how as a child you lived in Saudi Arabia, but you used to go back to Syria every summer. Tell us about the food you enjoyed as a child, for example, when you went back home.
I was lucky that whenever we went during the summer holiday, we would go for a complete 3-month summer holiday in Syria. And during those times, of course, my grandmother, she would host breakfast every Friday, where we would eat a lot of specialty breakfast dishes. Hummus, for example, that is special to eat it during breakfast on the weekend, but also musabbaha, which is another version of a chickpea type of dish, which I absolutely adore. And also as a child over there growing up, even going onto the market on the street foods, I think that is something that is completely special for me coming from Saudi to Syria, where I can like go on the adventures of going from one kiosk to one food stall with shawarma, like really great shawarma, and toshka, which is very typical sausage between bread and cheese, on which is a very typical street food. And there is more and more stories of really special food memories in Syria.
Tell us more about those food memories. What are some of the stories that come into your mind first?
I think one of the things that comes to my mind, or even one of the things that I would love to have it again happening, is the breakfast at my grandmother's backyard garden. This is such a special place for us as a family, but also for me specifically. And just to also give you an idea, on Friday, which was the weekend at Syria, it starts on Friday, and basically all Syrians, no matter who you are, on Friday, you would go to your grandmother for breakfast. It would be me, but also my parents and the extended family with my cousins. And we would be like around, I don't know, 20, sometimes 30 of us having a long breakfast with a lot of delicious dishes, but also followed by tea and more food and then coffee. Our conversations are, of course, about what happened during the week and catching up with each other. But even after this, we would start arguing, and after with full stomach, like, where are we going for lunch? What's the next stop for us? So that's really special, those relaxed times where the main concern was, where are we eating?
I guess that's one example that shows how important food is for the Syrian culture.
Absolutely, yes. I think a lot of celebrations happen around food. Food for the Syrians and the traditions and the culture of food culture is like really monumental in the everyday life of a Syrian, as it is like in many cultures, I can imagine, to some extent.
Also, looking at and discussing the Syrian food culture, tell us about the tablecloths. That's one thing you write about in the book.
Yes, indeed. It's called the Arabani. So Arabani is a very, very typical Syrian tablecloth. And just personally, when I was younger, I wasn't a big fan of those Arabani, to be honest. But when I grew up, I started connecting them a lot with where I come from, and it has a special feeling to it also. And this is a tablecloth where whenever you put on any table with some dishes on it, it really transforms the table to a Syrian feast, I find. Those are very traditional and almost 150 years old when they started doing it. And it started between Homs, and then this craft went into Dorma, which is in the suburbs of Damascus. And they are handmade. Because they're handmade, they're very unique on how they are printed. And each print has its own name. So really, each tablecloth is completely different from any other tablecloth. And it's always embroidered with very summerish and very flowery type of embroidery. I love it because it makes any table a real Syrian table.
How many tablecloths do you have with you in Amsterdam?
I managed to sneak in a few tablecloths from my grandma and my mom covered. Also, when I was visiting Syria, I bought a couple of others. So I think now I have almost 12 to 15 tablecloths.
Now tell us, Anas, obviously when people think about Syria, people think about what's been happening in the last recent years, and we know that there's been a wave of Syrian refugees arriving in Europe, including in Amsterdam. How have you seen that change over there in Amsterdam when the Syrian population has grown over there? Has that meant that there is, for example, more Syrian food around?
Absolutely. When I arrived in the Netherlands in 2013, I was actually struggling to find some really good Syrian food. But later on, especially when the refugees, they came more and more into the Netherlands, but all around Europe, you see many other shops that have opened with amazing, delicious Syrian dishes. And that only brought in different and the new kind of also perspective for other people to experience not only the stories that they hear on TV, but really the food culture and the taste of Syrian food much closer to people. I really feel that food really brings people together and can help in trying to understand and start articulating and speaking together. So I just find it amazing when this kind of food phenomena that happens over here, how it's translated to bringing people closer together.
And just finally, Anas, before I let you go, we have to talk about the food you write about in the book and those dishes and recipes you give us. If I would ask you to give us a recommendation, our listeners, what kind of ingredients should they look out for? And what do you suggest they should try to cook? Something Syrian.
That's easy. If you say an ingredient, I'm going to tell you sumak, the name of the book. So I would recommend them to bring sumak, because sumak is such a versatile type of ingredient that you can really use in fish, meat, chicken, soup, salads. It also brings a very distinct taste, like tangy taste that is very distinct to sumac. So if I would say at least a spice, I would say sumac. But also, of course, tahini is amazing and also very delicious with many fish dishes, but also a lot of the dips has tahini. So also tahini is a very good recommendation. And yes, one more, actually, pomegranate molasses. This is something that I even, instead of going to friends and bring wine to them, I sometimes bring them a bottle of pomegranate molasses. That is such a really lovely sweet and sour and goes really well with salads and with muhammara, the spicy dip. So I highly recommend pomegranate molasses.
Give us a couple of recipe recommendations too. What are some of your favorite dishes from the book people should try?
For breakfast, I would recommend musabbaha. Musabbaha is very similar to hummus, almost the same ingredient, but funny enough, it has a very different feeling and taste to it when it's a bit warmer and a bit more coarse, not very creamy. And this is very typical for a weekend breakfast. So I would recommend this for a good weekend breakfast. Maybe for a bit more main course, I love mujaddara. Mujaddara, it's like very simple type of dish, and it's also common in a couple of other Levant cuisines. It's very simple, three main ingredients, caramelized onion, rice, and lentil. But somehow, if you put those together with a little bit of spice, it's magical. And so simple, but really delicious. So I would recommend that for your main course. And if I were to recommend a dessert, I love the shaibiyat. Shaibiyat is like a phyllo dough stuffed with ashta, which is a ricotta-type cheese with some raspberry filling. I'm now hungry.
Anas Atassi there. His new cookbook is called Sumak Recipes and Stories from Syria, and it's out now. And that's all for this edition of The Menu. For previous episodes of this program, go to Monocle's website, SoundCloud or Apple Podcasts. And remember to subscribe to the show so that it automatically arrives onto your device every week. Also, do check out our Menu spin-off show, Food Neighborhoods, for great recipes. This show was edited and mixed by David Stevens, and I am Markus Hippi. Once again, we finish this program with a dinner soundtrack recommendation. Here is Shamis with She Can't Love You. Thanks for listening.
Hi. Yeah. Saw you last night. I was at the club. Yeah. Saw who you were with, too.